in an apartment building off Commercial Drive. The younger brother of a friend of mine, someone I had gone to school with. I can't remember his name. Sweet man, in his late 20s. I do remember his eyes and his warm, open smile, his joyfulness, his aliveness. He got the flu one day, and by the end of the week, he was dead. That was AIDS in 1986. It swept through the gay community, the needle injection community, the community that needed blood transfusions, and it swept through the creative community here in Canada, in the United States. A generation of artists were lost. People I loved, mentors, colleagues, friends, neighbors. There was a decade or two when everyone knew someone who either had HIV or had died of AIDS. That was 27 years ago. It seems like a long time when you count up the years, and at the same time, it feels like yesterday. Now, I grew up hearing the stories of the Great Depression and World War II from my parents' generation, just as they heard the stories that formed their parents. Each generation tells its formational stories. This is the story of my generation, the generation of artists who came of age in the 80s and the 90s. And the play, Angels in America, is a description of that time. When I introduced the play, when I introduced the play Angels in America to acting students, I begin by picking out one-third of the class. And I ask them to stand. And then I have everybody look around the room at each other and the relationships that they have with each other. And then I say, the people that are standing would have been dead by the end of the 90s. Trying to make it real for them, who live in a world now where AIDS is not a death sentence. It was a terrifying plague because no one at first knew where it was coming from. And then it was a terrifying plague because no one knew how to stop it. Angels in America, subtitled A Gay Fantasia on National Themes, is written in two full-length parts. Part one is called The Millennium Approaches, and part two is called Perestroika. It's written by Tony Kushner. Angels in America played London in 1992, Los Angeles and New York in 93. It won the Pulitzer Prize, the Tony Award, and the New York Drama Critics Award for Best New Play in those years. It was turned into a mini-series by HBO in 2003. And it is now considered one of the most important contributions to English literature in the 20th century. To tell the story is a bit complicated because, well, for many reasons. There's 21 characters just in the first play alone. There are multiple realities. There's the waking reality, there's spiritual reality, there's drug-induced and fantastical realities. Time also shifts in the play. And each character plays many parts, both of their own gender and of another gender. It covers sexual identity, gender identity, political corruption and addiction, mental illness, AIDS, religion, and our human will to live. But I will attempt to give you a synopsis. The story opens after the funeral of Louis Ironman. Louis Ironman's grandmother, who had immigrated to the New World from a village in Lithuania or Russia, like so many, seeking a new life after the war. sitting on a park bench after the funeral, Lewis's partner, Prior Walter, reveals the sarcoma lesions on his body. He has AIDS. This proves too much for the weak Lewis, who after a particularly gruesome night, when he puts Prior into the hospital, decides to abandon his lover. The next day, filled with self-loathing and sobbing in the bathroom of the government office where he works, in comes another character, Joe Pitt, chief clerk of the Federal Court of Appeals, and a tightly closeted, gay, Mormon Republican. Their story continues. Now, after Prior has been in the hospital for a while and is beginning to recover, although he is still covered in cancer, which is one of the immune deficiency diseases that was released by AIDS, Prior confesses to his best friend and former lover, Belize, that he's beginning to hear a most beautiful voice, and that when he hears it, it manifests desire in his body. Belize is worried then that his friend is getting dementia, another attribute of AIDS. But once alone, Prior speaks to the voice, and he says, "Are you one of those voices, one of those follow me to the other side voices?" And the voice that sounds like a perfectly tuned viola says to him, "No. I am a messenger, and I am on my way. Prepare." Now, in between Prior's story parts is the story of Lewis and Joe Pitt and their very unlikely relationship. And there is Joe's wife, Harper, who cannot reconcile her sense of truth about her husband's internal identity struggle with the wall of denial that he pushes her away with. She survives by taking great fists full of Valium and goes off to traveling. She travels in Antarctica, literally. And there is Joe's mother, who after Joe confesses to her that he is gay from a phone box in Central Park in the middle of the night, immediately sells the house in Salt Lake City and moves to New York to find her son to help him. And then there is Joe's boss, Roy Cohen. He was a real person in history. Roy Cohen was a leading force behind the McCarthy trials, a lawyer who prosecuted Ethel Rosenberg for conspiracy and manipulated illegally behind the scenes so that she was assured to get the death sentence. He was one of the most corrupt men in America at the time. He was also a closeted gay man who died of AIDS in 1986. These are the stories that surround the character Prior Walter. Now, at the end of part one of Angels in America, Prior is alone in his bed, and he hears the approaching sound of the beating of huge, huge wings. He's terrified. The bed light beside him flickers, and the bedroom is filled with changing colors. And then a sound like a plummeting meteor tears down from the very, very, very far edges of the world, hurtling at an incredible velocity towards his bedroom. Then just as all light is sucked out of the room, we hear a terrifying crash as something immense hits Earth. The whole building shudders, and part of the bedroom ceiling crashes to the floor. And then suddenly, in a shower of unearthly light, spreading great opalescent gray silver wings, the angel descends into his room and announces, "Greetings, prophet. The great work begins. The messenger has arrived." And that's where the first play ends. Talk about a hook to come back to the second part of the play. Not just the intermission, you'd have to come back later that night. Now, we only learn in the second play, Perestroika, of the story behind why the angel crashes through the ceiling into Pryor's room. The premise is that God has left the universe. He left because God, like humanity, needed to respect momentum, needed to move, to migrate, to continue God's journey. This has left the angels in heaven in an administrative dither. As they don't know how to run the universe without God. But they have a book of prophecy that says that a human prophet can solve their problems by choosing to stop the momentum or the desire to continue living. This is the great work, according to the angel. Have the prophet proclaim to all humans that it is now time to stop, to choose death over life. Simple. Pryor is the chosen prophet. And he's well chosen because he has every reason in the world to stop, to give up. His immune system is not functioning, his body ravaged by a host of diseases, his one true love has abandoned him, the world he lives in is filled with pain and loss and suffering. Justice and political power has been corrupted by evil people like the lawyer Roy Cohn. The true moral compass, the true human moral compass, has been hijacked by religions bent on power and control. And the polar ice caps are melting because carbon dioxide has destroyed the ozone and the atmosphere, and most people are just simply confused and lost and hiding in fantasy and denial. He has every reason to take up the task of prophet and proclaim that humans must stop this desire for movement. But he doesn't. Instead, from his hospital bed, he wrestles that angel and defeats her, and wins the opportunity to enter heaven and return the book of prophecy. Here he speaks to the administrators of heaven, the angels. Pryor says, I want to return this. We just can't stop. We're not rocks. Progress, migration, motion is modernity. It's animate. It's what living things do. We desire. Even if all we desire is stillness, it's still desire for. Even if we go faster than we should, we can't wait. And wait for what? God? God. He isn't coming back. If he ever dared show his face or his glyph or whatever in the garden again, if after all this destruction, if after all the terrible days of this terrible century, he returned to see how much suffering his abandonment has created, if all he has to offer is death, excuse the language, you should sue the bastard. That is my contribution to this theology. Sue the bastard for walking out. How dare he? So thank you for sharing this with me, but I don't want to keep it. I'm 31 years old, for God's sakes, and I haven't done anything yet. I want to be healthy again. And this plague, it should stop too. In me and everywhere. Make it go away. I want more life. I can't help myself. I do. I've lived through some terrible times, and there are people who lived through far worse than me. But you see them living anyway. When they're more spirit than body, more sores than skin, When they've been burned and in agony, when flies lay eggs in the corner of the eyes of their children, they live. Death usually has to take life away. I don't know if that is just the animal. I don't know if it's not even braver to die. But I recognize the habit, the addiction to being alive. We live past hope. If I can find hope anywhere, that's it. That's the best I can do. It's so much not enough. So inadequate, but I want you to bless me anyway, and I want more life. So says Prior Walter. Now, I've seen a number of productions of this play, both the first and second parts, and I've worked on many of the scenes with students, but none of them reached the transformational experience that I had of a traveling Los Angeles company at the Queen Elizabeth Theater here in Vancouver. The experience is impossible to recreate. It's not unlike trying to describe an absolutely superb piece of music or a painting or a spiritual experience. What I can say is that if the actor playing that part of Walter Prior, the man who's lost everything, yet has the fortitude and the self-respect and the human tenacity to fight, to live, if this actor has the bravery to play this part from the edge of his creative life, play it with his soul, if an actor is willing to go there, he will take his audience with him. And they will hear his words from their hearts and their souls. And as he is transformed in the play, so will the audience be. And that evening, that day in the theater, we had such an actor. When the play concluded and the curtain fell, there was no sound in that theater. 1,000 people, silent. No one clapped. Complete silence. I can only assume that people felt the way I did, which was wrung out and filled to the brim, overwhelmed. Eventually, of course, the audience began to applaud and the actors were brought back for ovation after standing ovation. And then the applause ended, the curtain finally fell, and many of the audience just continued to sit in the theater, reluctant to leave the space where we had experienced such truth, such depth. These kinds of shared experience are so rare in our lives. We find them sometimes when people gather for music concerts or in the theater. You can probably think of other times, places. But it is significant that in these transformational experiences, because we are together with a great body of humanity and we feel it and move through it together. And what is that it? Now, I would say it was the Holy Spirit transported through the medium of art. The Holy Spirit, the creative spirit, pick whichever word touches you and is real for you, because the word is not important. It's the experience. And not only the experience, but that you have the opportunity to experience it, and that when you have that opportunity, you're ready. And you're able to say yes to that experience. Now, any moment can be a transformative moment. But I think it's the shared moments in our secular society today which are most often found when people come together to experience the arts, creativity, And that is why it was such a terrible blow to my generation when we lost so many creative souls back in the 70s, the 80s, and the 90s. Today, 2013, we know that AIDS is no longer a death sentence. It's no longer the mysterious and terrifying plague that it was 30 years ago. Those who get AIDS now, at least in North America, can live full lives, productive lives, if they have access and can afford the medications that they need. In other parts of the world, AIDS obviously is still rampant, but progress is still being made. In 2011, there were 1.7 million AIDS-related deaths in the world, which has dropped hugely since 2005, when it was up at 2.3 million. We have come a long way in 30 years, and there's still much work to be done, especially in compromised countries where the access to health services, good information, and practices of safe sex are still not happening. In many of these countries, it's the storytellers, the actors, who are working with the health professionals to bring into the communities the crucial health information that is needed. And so there's a kind of circle there. Art and creativity is what we humans do to express our aliveness. Art is not just for moments of transformative beauty. Art is also a vehicle that can save lives. And so, our journey here continues. Thank you.